Coming up on Star Stuff, Earth's magnetic field far more ancient than previously thought. The first aurora detected beyond our solar system. And Rosetta's Philae lander reveals the secrets of Comet 67P. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
A new study has found Earth's magnetic field is at least 4.22 billion years old. That means it was present not long after the planet formed, and therefore far older than previously thought. The findings, reported in the journal Science, help us improve our understanding of the evolution of Earth's ancient atmosphere, and possibly also the beginnings of life on the planet. One of the study's authors, Professor Francis Nemo from the University of California, Santa Cruz, says the discovery opens a window into a period we know almost nothing about. Before this study, scientists knew that a magnetic field producing geodynamo had existed around 3.5 billion years ago. What this study has done is push that age back by another 800 million years. Earth's magnetic field acts like a shield, protecting the atmosphere and water which makes life on Earth possible. Without this magnetic field, Earth's atmosphere would have been eroded away by the solar wind, the stream of charged particles constantly flowing out from the sun. The magnetic field was of special importance to the Earth early in its history, when the solar winds were about 100 times stronger than they are now. Earth's magnetic field is generated by a geodynamo in the planet's liquid iron outer core. Mercury also still has a magnetic field. And remnant magnetism on the surface of the red planet indicates Mars too once had a geodynamo-driven magnetic field early in its history. However, Mars is only about a third the size of the Earth, so it cooled down far more quickly, and once its core solidified, its geodynamo-driven magnetic field disappeared. The reason Mars lost its atmosphere and most of its water isn't simply because it has less gravity, but also because it lost its magnetic field, which protected the atmosphere from being blown away by the solar winds. The new date for Earth's magnetic field is based on the record of magnetic field strength fixed in magnetite, a naturally occurring magnetic iron oxide, at the time the magnetite minerals cooled from their molten state. The magnetite was preserved inside zircon crystals from the Jack Hills sedimentary deposits of Western Australia. Jack Hills zircons are famous because they're the oldest minerals we know of on this planet. They've been used in many studies to find out about Earth's ancient atmosphere and whether there was liquid water on the early Earth. The authors used a very advanced magnetometer to measure the magnetic intensity of the magnetite. However, the team also had to ensure that the magnetite within the zircon was pristine and hadn't been reheated from later events, which could have erased the original dates. The authors established that the zircons had not been moved relative to each other from the time they were deposited. Now, if the magnetic information in the zircons had been erased and re-recorded, then the magnetic directions would have been identical. Instead, the researchers found that the minerals had varying magnetic directions, indicating they were in a pristine state for at least some 4 billion years. The intensity measurements of the magnetic field reveals a great deal about Earth's geodynamo at the time the magnetite solidified. Prior to this research, the best estimate of the age of Earth's magnetic field had been between 3.2 billion and 3.45 billion years ago, based on magnetite-bearing single feldspar and quartz phenocrysts from igneous rocks in the Nonwini and Barberton greenstone belts of South Africa.
Before this study, we knew that the dynamo had existed for the last 3.5 billion years. And what this study has done is to push back the age of the dynamo by another 800 million years. What that means is that there was probably a dynamo operating even before the last big things were whizzing around hitting the Earth and the Moon. And so it's giving us an insight into really the earliest stages of the Earth's thermal evolution.
So does this mean that the dynamo began while the Earth was still a magma ocean?
We don't know that yet, but the Earth was probably a pretty active place early on, and so there are a couple of ways by which a dynamo could have been operating very early. And in particular, when the Earth started out extremely hot, and so it was probably cooling very fast, and that fast cooling was probably quite effective at driving a dynamo inside the Earth's iron core.
Why is it important to know the age of the geodynamo? How does that help us in terms of, I guess, looking at the early Earth and also, I guess, early Mars?
Right. Well, one of the big implications is that this actually has an effect on the atmosphere, because particularly with the young sun was very active, and it sends out a solar wind, and that solar wind can strip away the atmosphere. And so if the Earth had a magnetic field, it would have protected the Earth's atmosphere from being stripped away by that solar wind. And so having a strong magnetic field early on is a good thing, because it allows you to hang on to your atmosphere. What we think happened at Mars is that Mars did have a dynamo early on, but then that dynamo died. And so part of the reason that Mars lost its atmosphere is not simply that it's got a smaller gravity, but also that it didn't have a magnetic field protecting the atmosphere from being blown away.
How did you do the research? What was actually involved?
I'm a theoretician, and so I only came in, you know, at the tail end of it, but I can tell you what I understand of what they did. So it's looking for a needle in the haystack. What you're looking for are these little minerals called zircons, which are extremely hard, they're extremely resistant, and they get incorporated into rocks. And so you break the rock apart and you extract the zircons. And then there are lots and lots of zircons, but only some of them are really ancient. That's why zircons are so important. But some of them are as old as, you know, 4 or 4.5 billion years. So you break the rock apart, you extract the zircons. Then you start to try and find the zircons, which are the oldest. And of those really ancient zircons, some of them might act as good magnetic recorders. But the trouble is that you can't tell which are the oldest ones before you've done the magnetic measurements, because making the age measurements destroys the zircons. So you have to do lots of magnetic measurements and then only find out what the ages are afterwards. So it's very, very labor intensive. And you have to be extremely careful to try and make sure that the magnetic recording of the zircons, they're recording an old magnetic field, but that magnetic field hasn't been reset later in time. So there are tests you have to do to try and work out when that magnetic field was recorded. So it's a very labor-intensive process.
This particular group of zircons from Jack Hills in WA, they've given you this figure which supersedes the Greenbelt figure from South Africa.
That's right, yeah. So the Jack Hill zircons are famous because those are the oldest minerals that we know of, at least on this planet. And so they've been used in many studies to try and find out things about the Earth's ancient atmosphere, whether there was liquid water on the very early Earth. So the Jack Hills is an extremely important geological site. It was incredibly exciting to me because it's the first time that we know anything about the Earth's magnetic field before the last planet was hit by lots of asteroids. There's this idea that comes from the moon that all the planets in the inner solar system were bombarded by lots of asteroids 3.9 billion years ago. So there was this sort of spike of impacts, and that's erased a lot of the evidence of what happened before. But these zircons apparently survived that impact, and so they're telling us something about the state of the Earth before it was hit by all these objects. And so it's a window into a period that we know almost nothing about.
That's Professor Francis Nemo from the University of California, Santa Cruz. Scientists have seen their first aurora beyond our solar system. The spectacular celestial light shows often seen during geomagnetic storms at higher latitudes on Earth have for the first time been detected in the atmospheres of failed stars known as brown dwarfs. The findings reported in the journal Nature indicate brown dwarfs may be far more planet-like than astronomers had previously thought. The study's lead author, Professor Greg Hallinan from the California Institute of Technology, says it's both the first time auroras have been detected on brown dwarfs and the first time they've been seen beyond our solar system. Brown dwarfs are failed stars. They don't have enough mass to reach the necessary core temperatures and pressures for nuclear fusion, the process which makes stars like our sun shine. Instead, brown dwarfs fill the gap between the smaller stars known as red or M-class dwarfs and the largest planets, gas giants like Jupiter. A typical brown dwarf would have maybe 20 times the mass of Jupiter, the biggest planet in our solar system. All planets with magnetic fields produce auroras when charged particles in the solar wind interact with the planet's magnetosphere, causing the particles to spiral down the planet's magnetic field lines and collide with atoms and molecules in the atmosphere. The emissions are seen at optical wavelengths as spectacular curtains of light high in the atmosphere, and they can also be detected in radio wavelengths beaming out like a lighthouse signal. Over a five-year period, Helen and colleagues used both optical and radio telescopes to search for radio pulsations and optical signatures of aurora beyond our solar system. The authors detected radio and optical emissions from a rapidly rotating brown dwarf named LSRJ1835+13259, located about 18.5 light-years away. When he saw the telltale radio emissions from the brown dwarf, Helen and speculated that it may be being produced through auroral activity. Over the past year, since that first detection, Helen and his team have found both optical and radio auroras and even smaller and cooler brown dwarfs. He says this tells him that brown dwarfs behave like giant planets rather than like small stars. However, Helen admits questions still remain about the exact process generating auroras on brown dwarfs. You see, in our solar system, it's the sun's solar wind which causes auroral activity in the atmospheres of Earth, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And limited auroral activity has been detected in the red planet skies above remnant magnetic Martian rocks. Jupiter also produces aurora, but through a different process. Several large moons orbit inside Jupiter's powerful magnetic field, including the volcanic moon Io. Io's volcanoes spew sulfur dioxide into Jupiter's magnetosphere, and as Io passes through the magnetic field of Jupiter, it creates an aurora on Jupiter's surface. Helenan says Jupiter's rapid rotation also helps power this aurora. However, the dissipated power from brown dwarf aurorae are at least 10,000 times larger than that produced in the magnetosphere of Jupiter. Helenan says without the stellar wind, aurora on brown dwarfs are either produced through rapid rotation or possibly by some very close-in planet orbiting the brown dwarf. He says aurora may be common features of all large-scale magnetospheres, and they could even explain some weather phenomena previously detected on brown dwarfs.
Brown dwarfs are kind of intermediate in mass between planets and stars. They don't have enough mass to give you the necessary temperature and pressure near the core that's necessary to give you nuclear fusion that powers our sun. They go through a short period of time at the start of their life where they can burn deuterium, which is kind of an isotope of hydrogen, but after that brief period, after a million years, they kind of can no longer sustain that fusion and they kind of just fade away like glowing embers. They no longer have their nuclear furnace at their core. So the question had often arisen whether brown dwarfs would be like stars or like planets, and that's, you know, in a variety of ways, from their atmospheric properties to thermodynamic activity. And groups were kind of interested in whether or not they would have magnetic fields like the sun. So the sun has magnetic fields that cause sunspots and has an outer atmosphere that's very, very hot called the corona that produces X-ray emission and radio emission. That atmosphere is a million degrees Kelvin. So the question are brown dwarfs like stars, and do they have like star spots, and do they have a really hot corona? Or, on the other hand, in our own solar system, we have planets, and they have much cooler atmospheres and very large magnetic fields that interact with the solar wind and give aurora. So the question is, are brown dwarfs like stars, or are they like planets? Well, when they were first observed at radio frequencies about 15 years ago, it was found they were very bright at radio wavelengths, which is unexpected because when you find the radio bright star, it usually means it's like this, you know, like the sun. It has a hot atmosphere, a corona. So initially, it was kind of thought, yeah, maybe they do behave like stars. But then, when I was a graduate student, I came along and I observed a few of these brown dwarfs, and we were actually looking at kind of very low mass stars and brown dwarfs because it's very difficult to tell which one's a very small star, which one's a brown dwarf. They're very, very similar. So we're looking at the whole population of them. What we found was that these brown dwarfs were pulsing. Every couple of hours, you get a blast of radio waves. Now, that's very, very different to anything that stars do. But we do see this kind of behavior in our own solar system from planets. And those planets do that when they have aurora. So what's actually happening is the aurora is caused by the interaction of planets typically with the solar wind, and as electrons are spiraling down and impacting the atmosphere, that gives you the aurora. That basically gives you the nice green glow we see for the Earth's aurora, for example. But those same electrons give you bright radio waves. And that radio emission is beamed like a lighthouse, so every time the planet rotates, that beam sweeps by Earth, and we see a blast of radiation. So
it was kind of, you know, when we saw that radio emission from brown dwarfs, we kind of speculated maybe these brown dwarfs actually have aurora. And over the last 5 years, my team and I have been trying to observe some brown dwarfs with a lot of big telescopes, both radio telescopes and optical telescopes, to try and see if we can see this radio pulsing together with the optical signature of the aurora. And finally, in the last year or two, we finally found this phenomenon that finally tells us that actually brown dwarfs do behave like giant planets, like super Jupiters, rather than like small stars. We now know the radio emission we detect is a very powerful way to measure the magnetic fields of brown dwarfs, and now we hope as well planets. When the radio emission from Jupiter was first detected in 1955, that's how we first measured and determined that Jupiter had a magnetic field. And why do we care if planets have magnetic fields? The magnetic fields of planets play a very important role. I mentioned earlier on when we have the solar wind bombarding the Earth, sometimes that's very extreme when you have a coronal mass ejection. You have an injection of a huge amount of material out into the solar system. That can impact the Earth and give us, you know, very intense aurora. And that's what we call a geomagnetic storm. But as it happens, our sun's quite a mild star, quite a benign star. A lot of stars are much more active. And the question is whether or not magnetic fields for planets is really important for protecting their biospheres, their atmospheres, for life. You know, whether or not having a very active star may redefine whether or not a planet can be habitable or not. And that's now a really important question to try and answer. And we think now we can use the detection of this kind of radio emission from the aurora on other planets as a way to try and find out whether or not they have these kind of magnetic fields the Earth has.
With the Earth's magnetic field, with Jupiter's magnetic field, we know the aurora is there. In the case of Jupiter, it's both from the sun and also from eruptions from Io as well, isn't it? That's also causing auroral activity. The same basic process.
Right.
What's doing it on the brown dwarves?
That's a very good question. So like I said, in our own solar system, the solar wind influences Earth and influences Saturn and Neptune and Uranus. But in Jupiter's case, it's a different process. Jupiter has a very, very powerful magnetic field that's very, very large. Actually, from our perspective on Earth, if you could see the magnetic field of Jupiter, it would be larger than the sun in the sky. It's very, very big. But inside Jupiter's magnetosphere, it has some moons, and one of them is very, very close, the moon Io. It's only a few Jupiter radii away from the surface, so much so that if you're standing on Io looking at Jupiter, it would fill the entire sky. Now, the fact that Io is orbiting so close to Jupiter puts a lot of tidal forces on Io, and those tidal forces are released by volcanoes, a huge number of volcanoes that spew sulfur dioxide into Jupiter's magnetosphere. And this volcanic moon Io was passing through Jupiter's magnetic field. As it passes through the magnetic field, it creates a very, very strong current that powers the aurora on Jupiter's surface. And as well as that, you also have rapid rotation that's powering Jupiter's aurora. So in the case of this brown dwarf, we know there's no star around which it orbits, so there's no solar wind or stellar wind. So it may be there's an Earth-sized planet sitting inside very close up around the dwarf that's powering the aurora. Or it may be, just like in Jupiter's case, that the rapid rotation is powering the aurora in a different fashion. We have a whole slew of observations over the next year with the Big Keck Telescope in Hawaii and with the Hubble Space Telescope and the Very Large Array in New Mexico to try and understand what actually is powering the aurora for this brown dwarf.
That's a very exciting possibility, isn't it, that the brown dwarf could have a planet orbiting it?
Yeah, it would be pretty cool, but it'd be already so close to the object. I don't think it would be one that where you could possibly have life.
Yeah.
But it would be very, very exciting to try and find a terrestrial planet buried so close to a small object like that. That'd be very exciting.
That's Professor Greg Hallinan from the California Institute of Technology. Astronomers say data from Rosetta's comet lander Philae has confirmed at least 16 different organic molecules on the surface of the comet 67P Sheremov-Gerasimenko. The discovery is being hailed as an important step in science's understanding of the origins of life. The European Space Agency probe landed on the 5-kilometer-wide comet's frozen surface last November. However, Philae's ice harpoons and gas thrusters failed to anchor it to the comet's icy crust on touchdown, and instead the lander bounced several times on the craggy surface before eventually ending up in a ditch, unable to maintain constant communications with the Rosetta orbiter. Its final resting place has also prevented Rosetta from getting enough sunlight on its solar panels to fully recharge its batteries, further limiting its operations. However, the data obtained during the lander's 7-hour descent phase and during the 57 hours that followed before the batteries went flat has provided fascinating data for scientists. These findings have now been published in 7 papers in the journal Science. Philae's initial touchdown on target at the Ajilkia landing site successfully triggered a sequence of pre-programmed experiments using the lander's 10 onboard scientific instruments. But shortly after touchdown, it became apparent that Philae had rebounded, and so a number of measurements were carried out as the lander took flight for an additional 2.5 hours, some 100 metres above the comet's surface, bouncing once and then finally landing at a separate site called Abydos, hundreds of metres away. Some 80% of the first science sequence was completed in the 64 hours following separation from Rosetta and before Philae fell into hibernation. And there was an unexpected bonus that data was ultimately collected from more than one location, allowing comparisons to be made between touchdown sites. Images from Philae during the EDL, that is entry, descent and landing, show variations in the comet's surface, which is covered with coarse material rather than fine dust, and is also far harder than expected. The images show a fractured and highly reflective rock surface, with erosion playing a major role in shaping the comet's features. Philae's landing images also show the surface of the comet is covered in coarse debris, rocks and pebbles, some measuring up to 5 metres across, rather than the dusty film of deposits originally expected. Scientists suspect the surface is partly shaped by a form of hail that occurs when gas ejections from the comet push out coarse particles and then fall back onto the ground. Under a few centimetres of dust, the lander's hammer encountered solid ice, similar to old solid granulated snow that evaporates and refreezes. Before it went silent, Philae was also able to send radio waves through the comet's body, which were picked up successfully by the Rosetta orbiter on the other side. It's revealed a surprisingly uniform, 75-85% porous interior. Following the first touchdown at Ajulkia, the gas-sniffing instruments Ptolemy and Kosak analysed samples entering the lander and determined the chemical composition of the comet's gas and dust, important traces for the raw materials present in the early solar system. Kosak analysed samples entering tubes from the bottom of the lander, kicked up during the first touchdown. These were dominated by the volatile ingredients of ice-poor dust grains. It revealed a suite of 16 organic compounds, comprising numerous carbon and nitrogen-rich molecules, including 4 compounds, methyl isocyanate, acetone, propionaldehyde, and acetamide, that have never before been detected in comets. Meanwhile, Ptolemy sampled ambient gas entering tubes from the top of the lander and detected the main components of coma gases, namely water vapor, carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide, along with smaller amounts of carbon-bearing organic compounds, including formaldehyde. Importantly, some of these compounds detected by Ptolemy and Kosak play a key role in the prebiotic synthesis of amino acids, sugars and nucleobases, key ingredients for life. For example, formaldehyde is implicated in the formation of ribose, which ultimately features in molecules like DNA. The existence of such complex molecules in a comet, a relic of the early solar system, implies that chemical processes at work during this time period, 4.6 billion years ago, could have played a key role in fostering the formation of prebiotic materials. Lead scientist for the Philae mission, Professor Jean-Pierre Bilbring, says the physical properties and composition of the comet are new to science, and like nothing he had ever imagined. Bilbring says scientists had expected to find an object held together by ice, but instead found complex organic molecules formed at the birth of the solar system. He says those molecules may well have become the seeds of life in Earth's oceans when they fell on our planet.
These grains are really the complex molecule that has been then put in the planetary oceans and probably played a critical role for the emergence of life.
According to Bilbring, some of these chemicals form the start of an evolutionary chain that could lead to the formation of complex organic compounds. Because the comets remain fairly stable and pristine since the formation of the solar system 4.6 billion years ago, it's acted as a time capsule. Bilbring thinks Philae's findings will help science progress considerably in its understanding of the origins of life. After Philae's batteries went dead, the lander went into a hibernation mode. However, the data indicates there were several occasions when the lander's solar panels did get enough sunlight to send a brief message back to the Rosetta orbiter before running out of power again. However, it was only in June that Rosetta actually received one of these messages, which was then transmitted back to mission managers on Earth. Rosetta is currently orbiting about 200 kilometres above the comet's surface in order to try and avoid the worst of the comet's dust and gas plumes, which are growing more and more active every day as 67P, travelling at 34 kilometres per second, gets nearer to this month's perihelion, the closest point to the Sun in its 6.5-year orbit around the solar system. Perihelion takes place on August the 13th, when 67P will be about 185 million kilometres from the Sun. On its 8th and so far last transmission, back on July the 9th, Philae sent a long burst of data. Unfortunately, the washing machine-sized lander has been silent ever since, raising fears it may have shifted out of radio range on the rough alien surface. In fact, the latest data suggests the probe may no longer be in line of contact with Rosetta, which relays its messages to Earth. Project leader Stefan Elmeck from the German Aerospace Center says the last telemetry does indicate Philae could have moved and that its antennas are now more concealed or their orientation might have changed. The data also indicates one of Philae's two transmission units appeared not to be working properly and a receiver was damaged. Efforts are being made to contact Philae by adjusting Rosetta's orbit in order to find a better connection. A bit like waving your cell phone in the air looking for a better signal. There's also the added complication that Rosetta's had to be moved further out in its orbit around the comet as its star reading navigation system is being confused by dust particles streaming from the comet. More from the ABC's Will Oakenden.
Back in November, during the small window Philae's batteries were running, the probe managed to send back about 60 hours worth of science experiments. Some of that data has been analysed and British scientist Professor Ian Wright is rather excited.
I see this cometary material that we're analysing as frozen primordial soup.
Ian Wright is the lead investigator for one of Philae's instruments that was designed to look into the composition of dust and other surface samples.
It's the kind of stuff that if you had it and you warmed it up somehow, put it in the right environment with the right conditions, you may eventually get life forming out of it.
The journal Science has published 7 papers laying out the analysis of some of the data Philae sent back. The papers include the composition of the comet, an analysis of the surface, and according to Dr. Alan Duffy, an astronomer at Swinburne University of Technology, the discovery of organic molecules.
This is a fairly spectacular result. There's 2 instruments aboard Philae. Basically, they found organic material on this comet, indeed 4 compounds of which we've never seen before on a comet at all.
He says it's a fascinating discovery.
This organic material will be the potential building blocks for life. Some of the compounds go on to form the sugars that are the backbone of our DNA. Some of the compounds go on to form amino acids, which we use in proteins in our own bodies. This comet is just chock full of the building blocks of life.
Did we expect to find organic compounds on a comet?
We certainly hoped we would. This is why the mission actually tried to land on the comet's surface to get a pristine sample, because we'd previously been able to get samples that have made it to Earth, or indeed we've actually flown through the comet tail and picked up some organic material, but all of these had suffered from the torturous path to our instrument. This, you just cut out the middleman and go straight to the source and you get a beautifully pristine, high-quality sample. And that is why you can start to identify all of these compounds that are in this comet.
When Philae approached the comet last year, the spacecraft's harpoons failed to operate correctly. It resulted in the probe not staying where it was supposed to and instead bouncing across the comet several times. The failure was a disappointment. It meant far less time for science and data to be collected than had been planned. But Dr. Alan Duffy says it turns out that all the bouncing has a silver lining.
In bouncing, we've actually got a really surprising result. We've been able to get a sample when it landed, but also we've got a sample from further away, mid-bounce. So that's actually given us these 2 quite differing results, actually. There's 2 science papers out from 2 instruments, and they both took their samples at different times, at so different places of the comet. So we're actually getting double the value. Even in a result where, at face value, it looks like a failure not being able to land safely, we've actually got even more science out of it.
Philae hasn't been heard of since the 9th of July, after connecting to its parent spacecraft Rosetta. It sadly may never be heard from again. There may be problems with its antenna or its transmitter, but Rosetta is still there, taking measurements and photos, and of course, it will continue to try and find and contact the little lander.
The ABC's Will Oakenden with that report. And that's the show for now. Star Stuff's produced by RN Science at the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. If you're in the United States and you're listening to Star Stuff as a radio broadcast, don't forget you can ensure that you never miss an episode by subscribing to the show as a free weekly podcast through iTunes. Just type in ABC Star Stuff in the search box and click subscribe. Or you can download the show from the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science/starstuff. We also have a Star Stuff blog containing all the space and astronomy news we can't fit in the show, as well as some spectacular spacey images and other things I find amusing on the net. Just Google starstuffblog.tumblr.com That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And for the latest Star Stuff broadcast times, radio stations and publishing details, join the official ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed. Just type in the @ symbol followed by ABC Star Stuff, all one word in lowercase, and you'll never miss a thing.